Hey, welcome back to Fast Forward, the podcast presented by Commotion, your regular glimpse into the future of urban mobility. As always, I'm your host, Greg Lindsay, and as always, I'm joined by Jonah Bliss, VP of Media and Marketing for Commotion. How are you feeling, Jonah? Commotion LA is behind us at last.
What a blast. I'm impressed that you and I are still upright and awake, but it was a fun week.
I think it was pretty great. I mean, 3 days, arguably certainly the longest conference we've done, you know, one of those pandemic era effects there where you can't be there in person. So you just cram it full of as many friends, new friends and people rejoining us from past editions of Commotion. It was a great lineup, arguably the best program we've ever done.
I think certainly the best lineup. So congrats to the programming team on that. And in a way, you know, it's an online event, so it never really ends. You can go and, you know, watch the sessions you missed right now, so it'll live on forever.
Speaking of which, so I would say for this week, due to general exhaustion and due because it was the fact that it was a great conversation, our guest this week and most of the podcast was my conversation with Wayne Ting, CEO of Lime, who, I would say, the day after Commotion made a little bit of news there by announcing that Lime has achieved profitability ahead of schedule. So you can listen to our conversation about sort of how they had a near-death experience during the pandemic and have really sort of come back stronger than ever. I thought it was the most interesting tidbit for me was the fact that, you know, this time around, they're not going to retract their scooters. We no longer have to compulsively wash our hands. So they're going to try to brave it through the winter. So you can hear more from Wayne in a little bit here. But what else do we got, Jonah? What were your favorite sessions from Commotion before we cover a little bit of the news?
Oh, God, there were so many cool sessions. I mean, I was really excited this year that we had that one that was sort of simulcast in Spanish and English, talking about, you know, sort of Latin American mobility and biking and micromobility. I love Mayor Garcetti's talk with the British ambassador. It was just, I mean, all around some cool content. What did you think?
I mean, the highlight for me, of course, fulfilling a personal dream there was the launch of the Global Partnership for Informal Transport, which is a new initiative, a triple threat between New Cities, Commotion, and Agile City Partners, which is headed by my friend and sometimes mentor, Benji de la Peña, past guest on the podcast here. And that's really going to look at, all the informal transport systems of the Global South, the jeepneys, the tuk-tuks, the tro-tros, which, of course, carry tens of millions of people every day, but really until now has been seen as a problem by their governments, something you need to solve and take out of sight. And now I think in part because of all the technology and all the money going into the sector past friends of ours like Gojek, who was at the New City Summit in 2015, and Grab and all these companies pouring in, now they see opportunity. And so there's a really unprecedented moment to sort of fix all that. So that was great, you know, and we had a really great equity track, and equity came up in almost all the panel conversations. We had a great double hit on the second day of the conference on rethinking our urban spaces and looking at the proximity city, as we call it here. Those really stood out. And then I think maybe the heaviest hitters was actually our discussion of public transport on the third day, where we had an incredible lineup there. Our friends Ben Plowden from London, Paul Comfort from Trapeze, who's run all sorts of agencies. And we just really had like one after another, this really smart conversation there. We had Nira Rez, the CEO of MoveIt there, and Joshua Shank, of course, again, and Karen Van Klusen, lots of good friends here who really got into the nitty gritty of like, how do we actually save public transit in America?
And I just want to throw in, I also really thought the proximity city panel, diving kind of into like, how do we stop this from just becoming another luxury product, like an urban amenity just for the wealthy enough to live in the city centers? I thought that was another, a great spin on a hot topic, but viewing it through a little bit more of an analytical lens.
I thought it worked out pretty great. Well, I would say, what have we missed this week elsewhere in the world of news? We've been so wrapped up in our own event that I've completely overlooked what's going on out there in the broader world besides.
Well, we broke some other big news at Commotion, of course, so beyond the GPIT launch, which is very exciting. Mayor Garcetti kicked things off by announcing the city's first transportation technology innovation zone, meant to sort of green light and expedite new transportation technologies in the Warner Center region of Los Angeles. A couple other, things that broke at our event was, of course, the Lucid Motor CEO revealing some of the sort of the secrets behind their new car and what they kind of learned from the Tesla Model S launch. And then last but not least, this year's 2020 LA New Mobility Challenge, we crowned a winner out of London, Zeddy, which is a very cool zero emissions vehicle, kind of alternative financing fintech startup. So lots of big news happening at Commotion and across the world.
Amazing stuff. Well, without further ado, because it's a fairly lengthy conversation this week, let's get into Wayne. So we had a good conversation at Commotion, talking a bit, of course, again, about sort of the whole trajectory that Lime had. I thought it was great. An audience member chimed in very early demanding to know the real story about what happened with all those viral images of jump bikes being landfilled. And Wayne did his best to address it there. Another one of those classic cases where, that line of the contract perhaps was not vetted by the people at the top there about who was responsible for which bikes, but they have come back, people have noted. So we got into that, and the broader discussion about, that Lime is, of course, trying to become a platform here and bring other modes onto it. So with that, without further ado, let's go to the tape and hear me with Wayne. But it's my pleasure to join you for a keynote conversation with Wayne Ting, CEO of Lime. Micromobility, of course, a constant theme throughout 4 years of Commotion. I forgot to mention to Wayne beforehand that one of our very first partners back in 2017 was a tiny company called Lime Bike. And so Lime has been one of our earliest champions when it comes to promoting this new mobility revolution that's happened here, and how we think about mobility has to go far beyond the personal car. So it's a pleasure to have Wayne on this afternoon here on the East Coast and West Coast to chat about, the last 8 months and what it's meant for Lime and micromobility at large. So thank you so much for joining us, Wayne.
Greg, thank you so much for having me.
Well, great. I guess let's get into it. I mean, obviously, you've candidly described the challenges that Lime has faced during the pandemic. The fact that you lost 95% of service, there were layoffs, there were massive pullbacks around the world as you retracted the fleet. And of course, there was the deal with Uber this summer on merging Jump into the Lime service and a cash infusion. I guess as an opening question, as the world prepares to go back into lockdowns, frankly, or at least by the world, I mean the West, what did you learn from that time and what's applicable from that? I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the internal processes at Lime as you realize the scale of what was happening and how it impacted your business.
Yeah, of course. COVID has been tough and it's been tough for us, but it's also been tough certainly for the world and any transportation company out there. And I think, you mentioned at the beginning of COVID, especially during the most intense period of shelter in place, we saw, people weren't moving. And when you don't move, transportation companies like ours really suffer. We had, I think, at our worst month, a 95% decline in revenue. And many cities actually came to us and asked us to pause service, because what they were afraid of was that transportation was going to encourage, more movement. And one of the things that that we saw, at the very beginning was also that people didn't quite know how this was potentially spread, and so people were very worried about the handlebars potentially spreading amongst people. I think what we found over time, of course, was that micromobility is part of the solution in a moment like COVID, because people are looking for affordable transportation. And we are open air single passenger at a very moment where the pandemic has spread people to people and is worsened when it's indoors. And so we've definitely seen a huge change as cities started to come back. More cities came to us and asked us to launch in their markets and ask us to get into more neighborhoods and a city. So as we're thinking about, I think the last month or so, Greg, you're asking that, COVID is getting a lot worse, we're hitting record numbers in the States, record numbers in Europe. We're seeing many big European cities go back into shelter in place, and we're seeing the same, degree of drop off, in the traffic numbers. But one thing that's interesting, I think, that we learned is that how to deploy better when cities go into lockdown. I think one of the things we learned early on was that very much commuter patterns change. There's no morning commute, there's no evening commute. People are not in downtown financial districts. You see trips much more evenly divided. You see much more residential trips, much more errands, people going from their home to their local grocery stores and back. And so one of the things we're doing is we're changing our deployment to meet this changing, shifting rider behavior. The other thing I think we learned in the last COVID was that shutting down was the wrong call. Because even if people are not going back to work, people need a safe way to do certain things, run errands, go see hospitals and basic key things. And we actually think of it as a core goal of ours to stay reliable during the second lockdown. And so the first time, I think cities asked us to stay, we also pull back. This time around, we actually have full fleet out. And in many places, we're offering passes that are a significant discount to so that more people can access affordable transportation. And we've also, as part of the first and this lockdown, provided free trips to essential workers so that we are part of the core transportation system. Lots to learn and lots of uncertainty, but I do think that we learned a lot, and I think we're going to serve this second lockdown better than the first time.
Well, that raises a good question. The session after this, I should mention, viewers, is going to talk a lot about shared mobility and sort of the public-private blend here. I'm curious. I mean, obviously in New York City, for example, and this, of course, I know Lime operates in the outer boroughs there, but for the first time in its history, they stopped doing 24-hour service. There's this real need. And going forward, of course, as cities are seeing these austerity budgets that are coming out of it from a lack of a federal bailout, they need gaps in the system. I'm curious, if you've seen more multimodal trips coming out of this or how you're sort of replacing that and sort of, if you could talk a bit more about the movement patterns you've seen and what that could tell us about really it's the future of where we work and where we shop and everything on the other side of this, because right now we're caught in endless debates about, will we ever go back to an office? Will we ever do a regular commute? Are there any other fine-grained behaviors you've seen?
Yeah, one of the most popular beginning spots and ending spots, in fact, the most popular in almost every city is a public transit stop. In San Francisco is... it's down where the Caltrain stops, in New York, in places where we operate, and Paris is always near the where the subways are. One of the things we noticed during COVID is that shifted and it certainly dropped in popularity. And honestly, it worries me deeply as somebody who cares about public transportation and about policy, because at the heart of any good public transportation system or any public transit policy is public transportation, because it's affordable. It's equitable. It's the heart of what connects each other. Our product, I love scooters and e-bikes and e-mopeds, but you're not going to take us to go 30 miles. And what you do as a steady user is a first mile, last mile complement to public transit. I think with perhaps some worries about safety, and again, I think all the studies I've seen is that I think those worries are overblown and our public transit system is safe. And the bigger challenge I think we're going to face is that you have a underfunding that is going to get significantly worse because COVID is going to have huge budget shortfalls in state and local governments. And on top of the fact that I love the President-elect's Build Back Better plan, which is a big part about how do we fund infrastructure. But there appears to be very limited support amongst a majority of Congress. That worries me deeply. And I think as somebody who is running a micro-mobility system, we need a safe, reliable public transit system. I think if you're in real estate, if you're in restaurants, if you're in anything that requires a healthy city, you want a strong public transit system. And that's one stat that we've seen that does worry us. We start to see that come back, but it's certainly not where it needs to be. And I think if there's one thing that would be beneficial to the entire transportation ecosystem is more investments in public transit and then more education around the safety of public transportation system during COVID. And I think, us talking about it is also going to hopefully help this, because I know everybody in micromobility, we want, we believe, and we support public transportation.
Well, what have you also learned about unit economics during this too? I mean, it's funny. I mean, before the pandemic, the big debates or the big worries for the micromobility sector were like winter and is there too much competition and interoperability and do cities like us or not? And, I think a lot of those debates have fallen by the wayside, but obviously, with the Uber jump deal, incorporating that into your fleet, how have the unit economics changed? And, do you feel like you have a handle on those now? Can you talk a bit about the improvements made there? And there's already a question, if you could address it in this question, already in the Q&A, someone's asking about whose fault is it that the jump bikes got trashed? An ongoing debate there about the poor demolition of those bikes. What have you learned from the unit economics on the other side of this?
Let me address the jump question, because I know, I saw the I share the anger that I saw on social media from a lot of bike enthusiasts who saw images of the jump bikes being crushed and being recycled or not being recycled, being landfill in a way. I think there was there were certainly mistakes in the transition. I think that what we purchased from Jump were, we purchased a group of the bikes that we were going to operate. And I think there was a remainder portion that Uber still held. And we actually, it was an asset purchase. And so we didn't know what was going to happen with it. And I think Uber made a decision to landfill. When we found out, we called Uber and said, please stop. We will take all of your e-bikes. You have an inventory, including used ones, including ones that you're demolished, and we want to run it. By that point, some portion of it was already landfilled, but we had, they hadn't done that in Europe or around the world. And we took every one of the remainder e-bikes, including ones that frankly, we didn't have capacity to manage, because we do think one of the most important things, if we're going to be a company that we're proud of, and we're going to earn the right to talk about things like a transportation system of the future and a carbon-free future, we got to make sure we are, our end of life of our hardware is done in a responsible way. Mm-hmm. We can't go back and change the past, but one of the things we think a lot about is we can never repeat that again. And there's so much need, especially during COVID, for people who are looking for e-bikes, and there's all these stories about e-bikes being sold out. We got to make sure that even if we can't use it, we find a home for it. And at the end of life, we are recycling whatever we can, we're using whatever we can, and only the least amount do we put into something like a landfill. Hopefully never, none of the amounts into a landfill. So I will take responsibility as the CEO of Lime, and I promise you that is not our intention. That is not up to what we hope to stand for in the world, and it certainly won't happen again. Now I forget your original question.
The other question it goes back to the unit economics of this, which is going back to you have a handle on this? Because this also ties into, the part of the questions about the landfill, as you point out there, is about, the ultimate sustainability of this. The sustainability of micromobility has been called into question because from a total cost of ownership and a life cycle analysis, a lot of the early models in particular across the board were wearing out very quickly. The images are being trashed. Yeah. Do we have a handle on the lifespan of micromobility to make sure that it really is more sustainable than automotive mobility?
No, that's a fantastic question. I think the industry has come along a long way. And I think the early times in the industry, not everything was done right. And I think one of the challenges was that I think the early industry took a consumer product that was not meant for high use and then put it into a commercial sharing space. And mm-hmm. I think what you saw was that these scooters were breaking down very, very quickly. Two and a half years ago when we started, the average scooter lasted 30 days. And that simply is not good. We shouldn't be deploying scooters like that. A lot of our investments in R&D have been about lengthening the life of the scooter and making sure that when they do break, we can fix it very easily and get back on the road. Because that not only reduces the cost, it improves the environmental impact. It also, frankly, is good economics. Because scooters that last longer don't break is good for the business. And that is where the interests were aligned. Today, our scooters on average last longer than 2 years. And wow. Every new version of the scooters dramatically improved the life of that scooter. And alongside that is it's definitely improving unit economics. One thing I always say is, the industry as a whole, we cannot be long-term achieve our goals if we only live at the mercy of venture capitalists. And one of the challenges with all these new transportation companies is that no one has ever made money. Not the big companies that you've heard of that are public, not the small ones. And that may be okay in a world where capital is abundant, but in the long run, we need to stand on our own feet and earn our right. Because the only way we can survive is through subsidies, then we can't scale at the pace we want. We can't serve the customers we want. We can't go into low-income neighborhoods, which are core to our mission, and serve those neighborhoods because we're going to have to make an economic trade-off. Being a profitable company is core to achieving our mission of serving communities and all trips under 5 miles. And so we've done a lot of work to improve that. The heart of it is Greg, what you're saying, how do we improve the life of the scooter and the amount of cost they have to go in to keep it functioning? And we made huge, huge strides. The carbon impact of a scooter is something that we care deeply about, which of course includes how long it lasts. There was a study that initially was talking about the early economics, and that showed something that was like 50% of the average, a scooter trip emits about 50% of the carbon of an average car trip. today we get an outside consultant audit on our own carbon footprint. The car, scooter trips emit less than 5% and dropping rapidly of what a car would emit. And on average, we actually have a lower carbon footprint than even a bus and a subway system. And that to us is something that we got to get even better at. And we're only 2 years in. We want to get that number down to 2 or 3 or 1%. That is core to our mission. We got to do better, and we are getting better.
I want to come back to the the business model approach. I'm glad you pointed out that no one's ever made money in this, because I was going to have to get to that point eventually. But I want to talk a bit about more of the platform approach you're taking in a second. But the other part of that, government relations, obviously. I mean, for a while, there was definitely that attitude by many cities that, we won't get fooled again, just as we were fooled by Uber, Lyft, and the others. And so crackdown on micromobility, I think punitively in the beginning, or asking them to carry too much freight. But how have relations with cities changed? I mean, early on, as you said, you've been offering free rides to essential workers. We've seen cities offer some subsidies, I believe, to Lyme in various cities there to provide rides. And also, this notion of thinking about, as I mentioned earlier, the 15-minute city model, proximity city, as we call it here, where cities like Paris are actively investing in infrastructure. I mean, one of the most interesting wrinkles, your competitor Bird early on with their Save Our Sidewalks campaign, the notion that they were going to spend money to build bike lanes. I'm curious how that's evolving. For micromobility to achieve its full potential, there still needs to be a lot of infrastructure investment. A lot of city policies need to change. I'm curious how those conversations have changed with cities around the world as well.
Yeah, I think in some ways COVID has been helpful in those conversations, because you're absolutely right. When we see micromobility succeed, there's a high correlation with good infrastructure. Our best markets in the world are in Europe, because these cities are oftentimes built before the cars. And there's always been a investment into bike lanes and protected bike lanes. And I think there is a higher awareness in terms of the carbon impact that transportation has on the world. And so I think in the United States, the conversation is sometimes more challenging, because I think sometimes there's a belief that if we invest in new forms of transportation that is cleaner, what we're doing is killing jobs in the auto industry. And when in fact, I think there's lots of studies and lots of belief that when we invest in clean energy and new transportation, it creates more jobs on the whole. I do think one of the things, if we want to have a transportation system that doesn't emit 30% of our carbon, that's on average, and most of that is cars, part of it is this transition from gas to electric cars, part of it. But you can't solve it all without talking about the fact that the car itself is part of the problem, because the car is 5,000 pounds. We are using 5,000 pound tanks to move humans that are 180, 200, 220 pounds. No amount of a gas to electric can resolve the fact that most of the energy is going to moving that car. And so, I don't think the future is only micromobility, but part of our answer on this public policy of where we want cities to go, where we want communities to go, needs to be how might we broaden the types of transportation system that gets public support, that has infrastructure support, so that overall, we're not just moving from gas to electric, we're also reducing the weight of our vehicles. And I think that's where Lyme comes in. When we talk to a lot of cities today, both because COVID has allowed them the space to rethink their city streets. Cities are taking over streets to put restaurants in. They're building more bike lanes. It's also a moment where people are taking the carbon climate crisis more seriously. We're having a different conversation that I think is enormously, enormously helpful. And it's a conversation that, frankly, I think, that is needed to be had, is that if we want our transportation system to be where it needs to be, it needs to be shared. We have too much personal ownership. It needs to be electric. And it needs to be low carbon. And the only way for we to achieve low carbon, it also needs to be lightweight. And so I think lots of policy discussions, and I think even the 15-minute city haven't discussed that, is also a new reimagining. It's a moment to reimagine transportation. And I think COVID has given us the space to do that.
Great. Well, I want to come back to, you mentioned, I thought it was great, the notion that, I mean, one of the classic critiques of micromobility early on was that it was literally like the personification of venture capital raining from the sky in the form of vehicles as investments tried to flood the zone and capture this new market. But more recently, you know, obviously that's changed, but also, you know, we've seen this huge explosion in personal ownership of vehicles in different types, right? You know, we've seen around the world, there's been explosions in e-bike sales. I think the United States, it was up triple digits. There's been some amazing stuff in Germany where now 10% of German households own their own e-bikes, and which is interesting in two respects. One, you know, there's been the critique that, well, does this stuff have to be shared? Maybe we should just own our own vehicle types. And second, the idea that, you know, that this goes beyond just simply the classic sort of service model. So as a way of sort of rejoining this, right, Lime has launched a platform approach. You're trying to become sort of a micro-mobility as a service, MMOS or something along those lines. Can you talk a bit about that and why, and also why just focus on micro-mobility? Why not do what your competitors have done, where they're trying to basically sort of vertically or horizontally integrate these walled gardens with multiple different modes with a similar pricing? You're sticking to your niche, it seems like.
Yeah, well, your first thing about shared versus ownership, we think the future needs to be more shared. If you look at any great environmental policy, it's reduce, reuse, recycle. The first thing is reduction in the amount of resources we put into whatever it is that we're doing. There are 270 million cars in the United States, 2.1 per household, 1.4 billion cars in the world. And itself, that the fact that it's largely ownership driven drives that inequality because not everybody can afford that. It also drives so much of our economy into it. The second biggest expenditure in America household after housing is transportation, because we're asking people, there's no easy way to share. And transportation is so core to what we do, so core to economic access to jobs, access to education, access to health, that we spend so much to buy that car, to buy whatever it is and keep it in our garage. The average car utilized 4% of the time, 96% of the time it sits idle, does nothing. That can be solved if we have a bigger shared model. I truly think that the future of transportation needs to be far more shared than it is today. And the impact is going to be greater equity, lower cost, better for the environment. And it would open up more of our resources to do many other things. It is core to our mission. On the second, which is we do see in that our mission, we always say our mission, we're not a scooter company. And I think when we say that, sometimes people roll their eyes. We have never believed ourselves as a scooter company. We are a mobility platform to serve all trips under 5 miles. And when we pick under 5 miles for a big reason, because 60% of the car trips are under 5 miles. And they're so poorly served by the cars, because you have setup time, you have parking here, parking at destination, you create congestion. These trips wouldn't be served by the cars if people didn't feel like I already bought that car. And so we believe the future, especially these under 5 mile trips, can be best served with lightweight vehicles, shared vehicles, electric vehicles. And so one of the things, what we also realize is that we don't need to own all the vehicles. We don't need to be the only ones operating. But what we do need to do is to give a user, a rider, the convenience to know that when they open an app, they can get all the choices they want. And so one of the things we did, Greg, you mentioned, is we opened up our platform. We're now seeing anybody can join our platform, put your vehicles onto the Lime platform so that we are giving the ease of use to our customers. So that right now, if you go to many cities, you need to get 7 apps. You go up to a group of scooters, you're not quite sure which of the 7 apps you need to use this. We want there to be one app where you can access all the vehicles. And the promise we have is that every vehicle on here is shared, it's electric, and it's light carbon. And we're going to continue executing that strategy. And we're going to focus very, very narrowly on this under 5 miles. People can do 30, 45 mile long trips better than us. And we don't care to be in that space. But that's 60% of trips that are under 5 miles. We want people to stop using that car. We want fewer people to buy cars. And we want to go and advocate for cities to take back more of our infrastructure away from the cars. Can I say one last thing? Because at the beginning, there's a lot of talk about all the vehicles being dumped into our streets. One of the things that I always thought was so fascinating was the amount of complaints about this, like scooter get-in, all of these vehicles. And I always get people send me a picture about a scooter parked outside their street, and they would be like so angry. Look at this crazy scooter parked on my street. Behind it, 100 cars. The entire world today has maybe 400,000-500,000 shared scooters and e-bikes, maybe 1 million at its most. There's 1.4 billion cars. We are blinded to the fact that cars run our street and they're everywhere. And yet we are so incensed when we say, can we use a little of that street for an e-bike? The conversation needs to be switched. We need to challenge the fact that we're totally comfortable with the amount of resources, subsidies, space, congestion, pollution coming from the cars. And we need to have a little bit of empathy when people say, can I bring e-bike to your street? And the first thing isn't annoyance because it's unfamiliar. The first thing should be, let's give it a chance.
Well, thank you, Wade. I would thank you so much for taking this time. We're unfortunately out of time and I have to host the next session. So I can't be two places at once, unfortunately. I want to thank the audience for some great Q&A in here. There's some great discussion, great conversations that we'll hope to endeavor on your behalf after this about you know the future of charging in the field, about sort of your path to profitability. There were some great nuts and bolts questions that we didn't get a time to get into, but thank you so much, Wayne. This has been an illuminating conversation to say the least, and we really appreciate your taking the time.
Thank you so much, Greg. Really appreciate it.
Well, that was a personal highlight of mine, Jonah. And what other clips can we expect to be putting out there into the world for those who missed Commotion but didn't really miss Commotion? You missed the camaraderie, you missed the chat, you missed the fighting in the comments. That was some of my favorite. At one point, people were arguing over hydrogen trains in my hydrogen session. But what else can we expect to see out in the broader web soon enough?
Yeah, watch out when the hydrogen fans meet the train stands, you're in trouble. one thing that I was sort of intrigued about, and there's just so much content we can kind of roll into quick hit podcast video snippets, but we had a rival that their chief procurement officer Tracy Yee on one of the panels, and they actually just announced this week that they're doing another SPAC going public.
What all the cool kids are up to these days.
Exactly.
Get yourself a SPAC.
It's headed across the Atlantic, so no wonder Tracy looked so happy during the event.
That is definitely one way to keep your mood up there, knowing what your options are now worth. Well, that's great news. Well, good. Well, I'm glad we'll see more stuff coming out of it because, there was just so much content and so much Zoom fatigue. So we'll make sure it's all digestible for all of you to listen to and watch at home. All right. Well, with that'll wrap up the episode for this week. Joan and I are going to get some sleep and we'll be back soon because planning for Commotion 2021, that starts today. So let's get to it. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you all soon. Enjoy the Thanksgiving holiday. If you're in the United States, stay home, wear a mask. You know what to do, folks. We'll see you soon. And we'll be back with another episode next week.